My name is Rusty Mackey, and you're listening to The Art of Stability. Hello, everybody. Today, I'm talking with Michelle Van Loon, speaker and author of many articles all over the internet, and many books, which you also can find and purchase on the internet, including her newest book, Translating Your Past. Listen, maybe you've never thought about your origin story, avoiding it like the plague, or perhaps you've thought of it often. Either way, in today's conversation, Michelle will help you see how necessary it is to understand your story, not for the sake of nostalgia or living in past regret, but to allow remembering your past to shape your present so you can live into a better future. If you want that, and who doesn't, then stay with us for Enjoying Your Life with Michelle Van Loon. Michelle, one of the things that I have noticed that I appreciate about you, and it's going to take me a minute to get here because I've noticed this in, first off, in your social media, and then also in your wonderful book, Translating Your Past, that just came out here recently. An aside here, I feel like, to quote Batman, this is not the book that we deserve, but it's the book that we need. As Americans right now.
Yes.
So I'm going to plug that in. But anyway, the thing that I've noticed about you is people in general can trend towards a nostalgia of the past, where that then leads them to a tribalism, where it's like, these are my people, and they can lose a sense of self in that. Mm-hmm. Another extreme I see in our culture is people can trend towards an autonomy separate from the past that lends towards an individualism where they don't have a sense of how their past or their people have shaped and influenced them. And one thing I really appreciate about you is that you have this strong conviction, this sense of where we come from and who we come from shapes us, but it's not determinative of who we are, that we can actually use that to grow. And so here's the thing I value, all that said. I value the courage that I see in you because it takes a lot of courage to be able to face your past, to stay present to what is, and then also a lot of courage to dream of a better future. Mm-hmm. And I see that in your work, that it is really balancing past, present, and future. So my question in that is, where do you find the courage to honestly hold the past, the present, and the future to hopefully see growth in your own life and then also to bless others and help them grow? Where do you find that courage? It's such a hard thing to do.
That's a super great compliment and glory to God. That's like maybe one of my top five favorite compliments I've ever gotten, because I've been really tried to be intentional about that. Mm-hmm. I think there is a very big difference. I've been writing about this recently, so it's interesting that you kind of put a finger on it. There is a difference between nostalgia and biblical remembering. Mm-hmm. Nostalgia ends up going rancid in our lives really quickly. And I'm 63, and I live in an over 55 community, and I live in Florida, so there are a lot of nostalgic people in my world right now. That desire for a past that never really existed, you know, mm-hmm. that you kind of filter and cherry pick just the pleasant parts, is not reality. You know, you can look back and go, oh, back in the 50s, everyone went to church and they were all well behaved, and you know, it wasn't this crazy, chaotic world that we live in now. Right, it is crazy and chaotic. But in the 50s, if you were a minority, your nostalgia looks very different, your sense of nostalgia. And in scripture, we are not called to nostalgia. We are called to remember. Hmm. And that the language of memory in both Old and New Testament is as if it's happening right now. the past becomes a part of your present because it's active. When we say the creeds or we pray some of the beautiful prayers in Book of Common Prayer or other prayers, you know, we ascribe glory to the one who was and is to come.
Yes.
You gave me an incredibly Trinitarian compliment by noticing that all of those existed, that we just don't exist in the past or for the past, but the past is to shape our present and drive us toward generative kinds of approaches to future. I don't have much. I'm fine with sitting around with a neighbor and going, oh, yeah, remember that Led Zeppelin album from the 70s? You know, like, that's fine. It's fun. You know, that's a part of my life or whatever, but I can't live there. And yeah. God doesn't ask us to live there. He never asks us to make yesterday great again. So yeah.
I love that understanding of biblical remembrance as bringing the past into the present in order to help us make choices in the future, right? It's a shaping dynamic. And as I work with people, and even in my own life, I do notice that we all, depending largely on our personality, can repress either the past or the present or the future. And we all have a preference of we either live, you know, in the past. It might be the nostalgia of yesterday. It might be the pain of yesterday. Some folks get stuck in wounds and grief. Or we might really just like be all about the present. And we're like the absent-minded professor and like nobody like really like, well, what are you going to do for lunch tomorrow? You know, like on this trip? Well, I have no idea, you know, or we get fixated on the future. So I think that's where the courage piece that I see with you comes in as I'm asking that question is it takes a lot of courage to really hold all three. So has there been a moment in your story where you had to muster that courage, or has that just been part of how you viewed the world?
I feel like it might be kind of how I've approached the world, because I don't want to be in the quicksand of the past. Even when I was a little kid, I would get in trouble in school for talking. I know this might seem surprising. I have a lot to say. I've always had a lot to say, I guess. And I'd get in trouble in school for talking, and the teacher would say, now go home and tell your mom what you just did today, because you're in trouble. And I'd be like, oh, I am going to go home and tell my mom. And then I would say, I need to remember to tell my mom this in 10 years when I won't get in trouble for it anymore. Like, I love history. I love story. All those things have always been really important to me, partly because of my Jewish heritage. I come from a long line of storytellers and story makers, but those stories have to have meaning now, or it's just description. It doesn't mean anything. It needs to mean something. And so when I was a young adult, I told my parents kind of collectively, I used to get in trouble in school all the time. And I just kind of thought, I will remember to tell my parents about this. I'm not going to do it today because I know I'm going to get in big trouble. And they're like, oh, we knew. We already knew, but that's sweet that you felt like you needed to remember this to give us this information. So not exactly the kind of scriptural remembering that I'm talking about, but memory is powerful, but it's because it orients us to the future that God has for us always.
Yeah. I really love this connection you're making between memory. Remembering is really the tie between past, present, and future for us. That's really fascinating. you know, I think of American culture and how individualistic we are. And even there's a lot of good story work being done in counseling, but even how much of that story work, maybe minus genograms, you know, can a lot of that story work can be just focused on us as individuals. And right. I really value the work that you're doing to say, hey, Western thinkers who are more individualistic, mm-hmm. Let's actually begin to learn from those in other countries, mm-hmm. those from other cultures. Mm-hmm. You mentioned a few moments ago your Jewish background. I'm assuming that is part of the factor that makes mm-hmm. you so passionate about that. What else has happened in your story that's kind of given you this real bent towards let's understand ourselves as individuals in the context of a greater community?
Well, I think for me, when I hit midlife, it happens to a lot of people. I shouldn't have been surprised, but yet I was. A whole bunch of losses, reversals, setbacks piled on all at once. To the point I was very toying with ideas of taking my own life, deeply depressed and super disoriented, just both of my parents had died. My kids were launching. We had some mental illness issues that flared among a family member. We relocated. Church imploded. You know, it was, go down the list, and the score of crisis and trauma was like a million. I found myself sitting in a counselor's chair, you know, crying and crying some more and crying some more. I needed to do that. But she quickly discerned that the work that I really needed to do was to kind of connect with all of these characters from my past. In the book that you read, I kind of share throughout the book. It's not just about me, but mm-hmm. I hit my story in some touch points. There was a lot of really hard stuff in my growing up years, in my childhood. It drove me into the arms of Jesus when I was a teenager, but it also kind of decimated my family of origin relationships because my Jewish parents, weirdly, were not super excited that I went to team persecute the Jewish people, you know, which is how they saw it. Yeah. I get it. I get it, but I couldn't quit Jesus either. So going back and being able to start to reconnect, this is who I am. I learned as a good evangelical teenager and young adult that discipleship looked a lot like filling in blanks in workbooks, showing up at church, giving money, and working hard. And that really appealed to my overachiever, helper mm-hmm. self. And I was pretty successful at it, except that it cut me off almost entirely from who I was. Mm-hmm. And I had to bury a lot of who I was. Most people didn't know what to do with an opinionated Jewish woman who showed up in their midst. I tried to behave. I really did.
I'm sure you did.
I was really bad at it. So, because I grew up in a house full of people that argued and yelled. And there's a saying in the Jewish community where there are two Jews, there are three opinions. There might be five opinions. There might be 15 opinions. So that doesn't play real well in a conservative Christian women's Bible study space. So I had to dial all that back. And that kind of muffling of who I was so that I could be, you know, fit in my Christian family, they were supposed to kind of help me since my own family had rejected me, meant that I'd lost just about everything all at once.
Wow.
So wow. I'm not even sure if that answers the question, but that's my story.
It totally answers the question. And what a disorienting experience mm-hmm. to have these overlaps of cultures mm-hmm. that are ultimately missing each other. And you're getting disoriented and lost in the middle.
And honestly, I think for all of the tips and techniques that many churches offer people, how to have a successful marriage, how to fix your finances, mm-hmm. how to raise your children. We don't talk about origin stuff at all. And even the silence communicates that it doesn't matter. And it matters so much that even if it's all dysfunction and chaos and crime, pretending it's not speaking in the present kind of eliminates, God chose to place you in the stream of people, maybe for new life, but also to bring meaning out of what's come before. That's an important part of our mission.
Yeah. It's so important. We can't know where we're going if we don't know where we were. Mm-hmm. Or definitely the saying is coming to mind of whatever's not transformed will be transferred, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
And a denial, living in denial is not helping mm-hmm. anyone. Well, thank you for sharing that part of your story. And I am also curious, coming into this time, I always ask if there's a story of instability that you'd like to share. And it sounds like you just shared one, so it might be part of your story. So whatever story you are wanting to share now, I would really love to hear what were some of the key transitions for you that helped you navigate that mm-hmm. instability? Mm-hmm.
I think for me, understanding, learning kind of about stages of faith. Fowler, I'm guessing you know who that is. Mm-hmm. And then all the writing that came after him. But I worked in a seminary for a while. And one of the things that was the greatest part of that job, I worked in the bookstore. Mm. A writer in a bookstore is
bad
like
news.
It's well, this is what they said. And you can read anything here. You can take it home, just, you know, record that you've checked it out. So I told people it was like Yentl goes to seminary working in that bookstore, because I would check out books, you know, and I've never been, what's the popular, you know, faddish Christian book. I was the one checking out textbooks like Fowler's Stages of Faith, because I needed to understand what was happening to me, what was happening to many of my friends as we were hitting midlife. Mm-hmm. Discipleship has always been really important to me. And if there's a through line, I've had 7 books published. I've contributed to a lot of other things. I've been writing my whole adult life to try to make sense of life.
Yeah.
But what does it mean to learn to walk with Jesus? What does it mean to follow? What does it mean to use Dallas Willard's excellent phrase, to be an apprentice of Jesus? Yeah. And that's the thread that ties everything together. Well, my understanding of discipleship, I've already kind of alluded to it, was you learn to do a bunch of stuff, and then you just do it till you die. And mm-hmm. in one way, that's true. We're not exempt from serving. We're not exempt from praying. We're not, you know, like those basic core things that you teach a young believer or a child growing up, like valid. But it looks very different as we mature, and especially if we start facing losses, we kind of hit that wall of midlife, the dark night of our soul.
Yeah.
It needs different framing and different understanding. So for me, being able to learn that and then to realize, I've never heard anyone in any church that I've ever gone to speak about spiritual growth and life this way. And why is this just left to the clinicians and somebody taking some seminary class? It's disconnected from our life together. So for me, having those conversations, I've written a book about midlife spiritual formation. I continue to speak and write about that topic a lot, because we often leave those in the second half of their lives who've suffered loss or suddenly find themselves as caregivers or whatever, you know, kind of like, well, you learned what to do when you were 17, so just keep doing it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, really beautifully said. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that stage. It's not that earlier stages are you're more holy or that there's something mm-hmm. worse or that you're advancing. They're just different.
And right. That's part of what the function of real remembering does, though. I think people often get stuck in nostalgia for the good old days or the youth group days or the 90s yep. or whatever, because they don't know how to integrate all of that. All of that that came before is for here and now. And this will be for the future, should the Lord tarry. And yeah. we just keep going.
Yeah, that's interesting to me. So you can get stuck in idealizing the past, but people can also get stuck in reinterpreting the past. So, mm-hmm. you know, as you mentioned in your story, you hit that phase of like, this isn't working for me anymore. I was experiencing all this intimacy with Jesus and now it's drying up. And mm-hmm. That's a very natural, like, okay, the Lord's moving you into the next stage of faith. Mm-hmm. However, if you don't have categories for that, people can look back and then they can think about that pain and mm-hmm. fixate on it. And then the whole season becomes tainted for them,
right?
Where they're like, oh, everything about that season was fake, or mm-hmm. it wasn't reality, or no one really loved me, or I didn't really experience Jesus. So as you, on this side of things, as someone who desires, has a passion to bring, not just, you know, hey, clinicians, like, let's share this information with the rest of the church. How have you encouraged folks who are in that space where they're either idealizing the nostalgia mm-hmm. of the past, or they are stuck in reinterpreting yeah. it as it mm-hmm. was all pain and all bad?
None of us like to push into places of pain. And family stories, I interviewed quite a few people for translating your past. And most people have some pretty amazing stories. If only there is someone there to listen and to ask questions. Yeah. You know, for people that do genealogy, I know some people might go, oh, well, this is a book about genealogy. Nah, not really. Because I'm really okay with recognizing that there's stuff that we might not be able to know unless you're really a total research hound. Yep. And you really love rooting around. I love some of that because I'm a nerd, but that is not my motivation at all. My motivation is take a look at all of what goes into making your story, which has to do not only with where people lived or why they migrated to here or there, but also trauma, racial affinities, geographical locations, cultural things. All of those go into our stories. And most of the time when people talk about family history, it becomes a very personal thing. But if we are the family of God and we are in church together, then all of those stories are there with us in church. Not that we're all there to do family therapy or whatever, sure. but to be able to recognize that this affects the way that we learn to walk with God, that discipleship happens, trust happens, strength happens, all of that. It's not disconnected. And it might actually be more important to the kind of family that we become than the tips and techniques of 7 ways to have a successful family.
Yeah. Yeah. So important. I mean, when you really start to think of the sheer amount of stories and experiences mm-hmm. that are in a room of a church family, and the church mm-hmm. family, as you said, is there to help us grow into Christ likeness. Mm-hmm. Yet people are getting triggered left and right all over the place from their family of origins
oh,
and reacting
yes, they are.
to one another. And so if we're ignoring this stuff, if we're disowning it, it will own us at the yes. end of the day.
Very well said, Rusty.
But very well said what you said also, in the sense of how do you help someone in that space? Mm-hmm. You be the family of God for them.
Right. And you try to figure out together, your story matters. My story matters. Yeah. Like all of those things that go into, you know, how did your family get here? Unless you're an Indigenous American or North American, you came from somewhere for a good reason. And there's resilience and suffering and sometimes running from the law and all of that. And patterns repeat. Yeah. Even if we say they, oh no, not with me, the buck stops here. Yeah. Well, that will to do that does not negate the fact that the pattern is speaking as well.
Yeah. Well, what a beautiful work that the church can do for one another in reforming a new family with new family rules. I just love, yeah, new family culture. I just love that imagery. Well, a very individualistic question for you now, as we've been talking about all of that, which
bring
is...
it. I'm an American. I know how to do an individual.
What have been some practices for you that have really helped you and aided you in enjoying Jesus lately?
I love this question so much. I didn't know what else you were going to ask, but I knew you were going to ask this. So I am ready. And it is discipleship related, and it's going to sound like it's out of left field.
Okay, I'm ready.
But I have taught in recent years twice a couple of different Bible studies that have gone through the book of Ecclesiastes.
Yeah.
And a nice sunny book.
Yeah, it's a great book.
So good, especially for older adults. Bring me Job, bring me Ecclesiastes, stat. One of the most shocking and provocative realizations for me was recognizing that enjoying the life that God gave me is a way of glorifying Him. Mm-hmm. It is as much a part of what healthy discipleship looks like as all of the spiritual disciplines. And that felt like a newsflash from another planet, to be honest, for me. Like, I know how to be, I can be hedonistic with the rest, you know, like I can enjoy a beautiful meal or, you know, a sunset. I live on the west coast of Florida, so we have got some amazing sunsets here.
Yes, you do.
That I never saw during my 60 years of living in Chicago. just not, every once in a while, there'd be a surprise, but mostly it was not as amazing as what's here. But reading in Ecclesiastes, eat your food with gladness, drink your wine with a joyful heart, for God has already approved what you do. Starting, this isn't from Ecclesiastes 9, it goes on. Enjoy life with your wife. Enjoy the days of this meaningless life that God has given you under the sun. I just thought, well, that's what I do when I'm not really serving God. That's what I do in my off hours. You know, like it didn't feel, I didn't understand how to ascribe enjoying the life that God gave me, connecting it with glorifying Him. He gave it to me. That is the language that the preacher uses in throughout Ecclesiastes, but in this passage in chapter 9.
Yeah.
And so for me, being able to enjoy my life, even if it's just the first bite of a great meal or the first bite of a bag of McDonald's fries or, you know, a beautiful flower or the song of a mockingbird, something I had never heard in my life till we moved to Florida, makes me be present, forces me to be present and just to savor, not necessarily to turn it into a big, long prayer or to do anything with it, but to recognize that by noticing, I'm glorifying God. And that is as connected to my spiritual formation as the other practices that I've learned over the years. So
I love that, Michelle. What a beautiful addition to this conversation where we've talked a lot about our past and translating it, owning it, allowing it to be transformed. And I'm just really present to you can't have that kind of presence when you have unresolved stuff from your past. So what I hear from you is as you've gone on your journey and done your work, that the Lord has actually opened up this space for you to be even more present to Him in the goodness of life, this meaningless vapor of a life that we have. What is your sense of the Lord as you are enjoying the goodness of your life?
I think at this point of my life, that sense of confidence in His nearness, in His Emmanuelness. There's no rockets. There's no big learning. There's just He is here. He's near. And I can trust Him. So as I've worked through some of the shame things that are a big part of my story, I'm able to just be. And that's a pretty cool place to be living.
Yes, it is. For those with shame, heavy and thick in their stories, it's also a miraculous place to be. And I'm just imagining as you're enjoying the meal or the McDonald's fries or walks with your husband or sunsets, I'm just imagining the Lord enjoying you, enjoying those things. And what an amazing God that we have who He cares about our enjoyment. It seems to me that there's something happening in the church these days. It seems that people are desiring to be present more and more. And I think that's a really good thing. And I'm just curious from your vantage point, if you were sitting with someone who's really struggling to be present, in particular to joy, right? What would you say to that person?
I don't know if words are the magic wand that will unlock that for them, but paying attention and being an active listener is a way of burden bearing for somebody else. And if they can offload some of that, and I can also not own it, my temptation is I feel everybody's feelings for them. They are so lucky to have this giant sponge of a human being. And I'm learning that it's not all that helpful. And it serves my own need to be needed, not necessarily, it's not helpful to them. But being able to be keyed in and focused, I'm not good at it all the time. It's something that I'm learning, but I'm kind of liking the process of learning this, learning how to be a neighbor to somebody.
Well, may Jesus make all of us the type of people who can be present to others and help them through that to be present to their own souls. And thank you for your work and this through line of discipleship and what does it mean to follow Jesus and your most recent work on translating our past. It's such an emotionally charged subject for all of us. And it's very helpful to have someone who's pointing us back to scripture, pointing us back to Jesus, and who has walked the road themselves. So thank you for your work. I value and appreciate you, Michelle.
Well, thank you, Rusty. It's been so great hanging out with you today.
All right, friends. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, would you like it, share it, or do whatever else you feel inclined to do with it so that other folks can find out about it? Check out the show notes to find out how to get connected with Michelle. And if you want to better understand your origin story, I cannot recommend Michelle's new book enough. Translating Your Past, Finding Meaning in Family Ancestry, Genetic Clues, and Generational Trauma. And if you're interested in the types of tools we talked about today, like a genogram or faith stages, then sign up for my newsletter, The Leader's Toolbox. Our world is complex, and those who lead well at church, home, or the marketplace are equipping themselves with tools for emotional and spiritual health.
You can sign up for that at Steadfast Men. That's steadfastmin.com/newsletter, or check out the show notes for a link. The Artist Ability is a production of Steadfast Ministries that exists to help you stay grounded in Christ to lead with confidence and clarity. The cover art was created by Brian Bim, music created and performed by Rob Main, and the music was recorded and produced by the Asterisk Company. Thank you for joining me, and I'll see you next time on The Art of Stability.